The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Arise, Sir Gareth, and the next golden generation. England tears Spain alive in Seville. Eric Dier goes through Ramos. Sterling and Rashford silence some critics for now. And Jordan Pickford Cruyff turns his way through an increasingly stressful second half. Elsewhere, Wales win in Ireland without three of their best players. What next for Martin O'Neill? Germany lose again, but play quite well. And Gibraltar are the most successful team on the Iberian Peninsula. Also today, a Premier League review. Wembley's not going to Fulham. And we've got a Scotch person here. So for once, we might actually do Fitbar some justice for the first time since Football Weekly began last August. And that's today's Guardian Football Week. And that Scotch person is Hayley McQueen. Hayley, how are you?
Hi, I'm very well, thank you.
A pod debut.
I know, right?
And you've bought gifts.
I have.
What have you bought us?
Well,
no one's ever bought us gifts before, have they?
The rustling of a paper bag.
Yeah.
A paper bag, so you know it's not come in a little cardboard box or fancy.
It's not a hold all of cash.
Here
sadly.
We go. It's Scottish shortbread, and it's actually homemade.
Stop it.
But no, I didn't make it in my home. Someone else did.
Well, hang on. So who made it?
I have no idea. The lady on the corner near King's Cross. Not that kind of lady.
Right.
There was a
1 minute it took for her to lower the tone.
There is a food market. It's very fancy around here these days.
King's Cross has changed.
I know, right? And she was Scottish. And she's got Scottish tablet and pies that I grew up with. Those little Scottish ones with the kind of edging on it. You'd fill the top with beans. That was my nutritious lunch back in the 80s. And she was making this shortbread. So how lucky did I get?
Well, that's marvellous. Yeah. And, you know, it wasn't, a lady of ill repute who has a sideline in artisan shortbread. John Ashdown, how are you?
I'm fine. I feel a bit bad. I've not brought anything.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, but you're a regular.
That's
you don't
true.
Have to.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is from James, who says, will the listening figures increase rapidly from Monday? Now a respected journalist is back on the pod. Barry, you're still reveling in being one of the 238 most respected journalists in the UK?
Yeah, you're never going to let me forget this, are you?
No, along with Piers Morgan and Jeremy Clarkson. Yeah.
You made it to a list.
Not the kind of list I expected to end up on, but yes, a list of the 238, very random number, most respected journalists in the UK. I apparently am one of them.
Hayley, you sound surprised.
No, it's great. Well done.
Yeah.
You're 238?
Well, it's alphabetical, so I'm mid to upper. Below Fiona Bruce and above Barney Roney.
Chris writes, do you think Jonathan Wilson has already started work on the book about how England reinvented football under Gareth Southgate, the Terry Venables legacy, perhaps? That was a great win in Spain. I'll go to an Englishman first, John. Can we have some jingoistic pride from you?
Well, no, actually. Well, it was very good, obviously. We're going to win the Nations League, but what do we get? That's what I've not really understood.
A trophy.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
There's nothing else that goes with it.
I mean, we may not win the Nations League. Spain could still quite easily win the group.
It seems quite unlikely, doesn't it? Yeah, no, it was fantastic. It was really, really entertaining. It was like watching a club game, which is not something you can say much about England matches in the past. That first half was up there in terms of performance level, with anything that I can remember, really. Going all the way back to sort of Holland at Euro 96, really. Fantastic.
First English win in Spain in 31 years. Spain's first home competitive defeat in 15 years. First time they've ever conceded three in a competitive home game. Barry, England are going to win the Euros, and I'll be watching it with you. And this time we'll do it.
Maybe you will. It was very impressive. I think the knee-jerk reaction was that it was even better than the 5-1 against Germany. I wouldn't go that far, but I was hugely impressed with pretty much every single England player had a good game. Harry Kane didn't score again, but had one of his best games I've seen him play in an England shirt, and he was kind of in a withdrawn role, which I think he claims to prefer that, but I don't think it suits him, but it certainly suited him that night. And, Gareth Southgate showed he's sort of tactically malleable or, you know, diverse. And plenty to build on there, plenty of reasons to be cheerful.
We spent a lot of this pod defending Raheem Sterling from
Haley from ridiculous criticism quite a lot of the time off the pitch. You know, if he buys a house, if he doesn't buy a house, if he buys an expensive pair of jeans or if he buys a cheap pair of jeans, it's always a problem. On the pitch, he hadn't scored in 3 years, but I mean, I was just so delighted for him to score.
Yeah, he is a young guy who probably needed that to help with his confidence, and who knows how that's going to go on and help him. Yes, I get why there is some criticism. There's the whole tattoo thing as well. There's all sorts of headlines about these young players. But if you can start making headlines for all the right reasons, and hopefully it'll just help the young man.
Eric Dier's tackle on Ramos. I think every football fan in the world would like to do that.
To Sergio Ramos?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it was so totally needless in such a ridiculous part of the pitch. And it was just really fun, John. I mean, you know, Ramos, the sort of ultimate shithouse.
It was one of those ones that just to let him know you're there.
Yeah.
By cartwheeling him up into the air. But it was part of the whole sort of enjoyment of the game and that kind of intensity that the match had. And it does make you sort of slightly wonder. You do wonder how happy, when you see tackles like that, how happy the clubs are about these games not being either meaningless friendlies or, you know, straightforward qualifiers where the teams are completely different in level. I wonder when it comes, you know, in a year's time, are we going to... If it might only take one or two sort of injuries for clubs to start.
You say the tackle was unnecessary, but like, a tackle like that can change a game. It can change the mood of the stadium. It can change the flow of a game. I mean, there's a famous Roy Keane one on... so famous I can't remember who it was. Mark Overmars, I think, for Ireland against the Netherlands, and Phil Neville's famous tackle on Cristiano Ronaldo in an Everton game against Manchester United. They changed the course of the game.
You mentioned that those comparisons to the 5-1 in Munich, and Gareth Southgate, I think, or a lot of people saying we mustn't make the mistakes of 2001 in Munich. And I spent 4 hours sitting next to David Seaman saying this, as David Seaman was sitting there going, I was in that 5-1 in Munich. As a Scottish fan, Hayley, mm-hmm. Do you enjoy watching England fans get carried away at moments like this, knowing that the chances are it won't work out as we hope?
Do you know what? Yes, I am a Scottish fan, but I consider myself British, so I don't hate the English. I am English. I was born in Manchester.
Okay.
So yeah, I guess my dad will hate me saying that, but he gets that we're English as long as we follow the Scottish national team, and I do that for my dad, of course. Do you know what? I love Gareth Southgate and the fact that he was handed that big contract not so long ago, and a few people, what's he achieved? What's he done to deserve this? Well, hopefully that win has helped make those people feel a little bit silly now, or think, okay, come on, fine, give him time. But I don't mind it at all. I actually went to see Scotland play England at Wembley, not back in the day when my dad scored and beat England for right. Scotland. Those days are long gone.
You weren't that one sitting on the crossbar.
Yeah, no, I wasn't born then yet, believe it or not. But no, I'm not an English hater, but yeah, your fans are very misbehaved sometimes.
Yeah, well, we'll get on to that. Gareth Southgate, John, does seem to be, as Barry mentioned, a tactical awareness. He went to the back four, he looked at the high line Spain were playing, and there just seems to be promise and progress from the World Cup to what we saw in Croatia and in Spain.
Yeah, it was really refreshing to see him be prepared to change it, given the success they had at the World Cup. I tend to think that when you play that three at the back, it's great for exploiting teams that you're already slightly better than or you're sort of level with. But as I think they found during the tournament, that when teams are slightly better than you, it leaves you a little bit open. And I think a lot of people would have just sort of stuck rigidly to what had got them to that semi-final. So to play that back four, and to, you know, to have a back four of Trippier, Gomez, Maguire and Chilwell, going away to Spain. If somebody had said that, you know, a year ago or 6 months ago, even, you'd sort of think, well, you know, absolutely no chance. And that's part of the, you know, part of the reason for optimism, that it was such a young team. I think it's the youngest 11 since 1959.
Wow.
I think I read. You've got 7 members of the squad for the 2 games that are still eligible for the under 21s next summer if they want to go. I know Harry Winks has said he's prepared to if he's asked, and it'd be interesting to see if they look to give players some more tournament experience, and as well as the people that were absent. You know, there was no Dele Alli, Lingard, Henderson and Stones were all missing, and they were all big players at the World Cup. So, yeah, huge reason for optimism going forward.
We're going to win it, Barry, whatever it is.
Maybe you are, yeah. I mean, I don't think there'd be open-top bus parades or whatnot if you won the Nations League, but, you know, England are in a very good place, but we would expect them to qualify for the Euros no bother anyway, and things may have changed by the time they come around.
George says, do you think there's a competition amongst goalkeepers to see who can do the slowest, worst Cruyff turn and get away with it? That was really fun, wasn't it, Hayley?
At least he gave it a go. I mean, it might not have worked. It might have looked a bit silly, but...
He's fun, Pickford, isn't he? I mean, that ridiculous save when it hits his head off Alonso in the first half. What's he diving? I'm like, he was just diving facing the wrong way and it just went off his head. I mean, and it was a penalty. It was a penalty. And the ref could easily have given a penalty and sent Pickford off. And then is it 3-2 down to 10 men?
Yeah, if you wanted to sort of put a little asterisk in the history books next to the result, you might say that, yeah, Pickford should have been sent off. And yeah, 3-2. We could have been here talking about England's implosion in the second half in their 5-3 defeat or whatever.
Do we have to accept that though? Because I mean, the pass to Kane for the first goal is stupendously good.
Absolutely. I mean, his distribution is excellent. He was the standout Sunderland player in a terrible Sunderland team. But even when, you know, as a kid, he was letting in 3-4 goals every game, but still putting in man-of-the-match performances. And you need strong character to come through an experience like that, I think.
Off the pitch, as you touched upon, Hayley, I mean, Jack Pitbrook in The Independent wrote an article about...
That's a terrific piece.
...about England fans and a sort of increasing anger and racism and misbehaviour and treating European cities with absolutely no respect. I don't know how to solve it, John. I don't imagine we will in this room. I don't know.
I'm not sure how you can solve it, because the problem is that football fans, a lot of them young guys, teenagers, guys in their early 20s, are going abroad to foreign cities, European cities, and they don't think they're doing anything wrong by sort of annexing a town square, behaving aggressively towards anyone who sort of goes into this territory they've occupied. They put up flags, they sing songs they perhaps shouldn't sing, they just behave obnoxiously. But you can behave obnoxiously without necessarily breaking the law. And so that their defence is, well, we're not really doing anything wrong, but, you know, you're a visitor. You wouldn't go to someone's house and behave like that, you know.
It's interesting that it isn't, or it's definitely not reported, and it doesn't seem to happen when English clubs go and play in the Champions League or the Europa League. I wonder why there would be a difference.
Maybe there are fewer sort of nationalistic overtones there, and you're there to support a club team rather than a nation, I suppose. And perhaps when England fans go abroad, the minds are sort of set on those kind of more patriotic. Patriotic's the wrong word, isn't it? But you know, those kind of things are floating around in people's minds.
Yeah,
now,
I wonder if you sent lots of. I mean, I don't know how many English police go with the England team. Or I don't know if, you know, the manager or the players sort of spoke out. They're in a very difficult position, aren't they? Because they want the fans on their side. But Jack was making the point that, you know, it's a very diverse team. It's a happy team. And it's currently being followed by quite an undiverse, unhappy set of supporters. I mean, look, you work in Scottish football, right? There's a lot of... There has historically and still is a lot of problem with, you know, some sections of Scottish fan support. I don't know if that is getting worse or... Since you've been there, have you found it difficult or not?
I think you may have some who as individuals would never go along with singing a song, but when you're grouped together with others, it's that pack mentality. You just go along with it, don't you? And before you know it, you've not just got a small section of fans singing a song, you've got hundreds, and then suddenly you've got thousands. I'd like to think that when these fans walk away, well, would I sing that in my front room to my nan? No, I probably wouldn't. So don't do it.
It'd be very strange. Yeah. No surrender to the IRA to Granny Moira if she was still with us.
But we don't want to see the point... We don't want to get to the point where we are potentially banned or banning fans because of misbehaviour. You saw what the atmosphere was like in the England game with no fans in the stadium. I mean, it was awful. It was strange. It was weird to watch on television. You don't want to get to that point, do we?
Those who say it's not really a problem always insist that it's a minority. I don't think it's that small a minority, you know. And the thing is, those people who are behaving obnoxiously and are going to drive away people who go and are able to behave themselves, they'll stop going and their places will be taken by more boorish, obnoxious nationalists, whatever. So I really don't see, though, what you can do about it, because you can't ban someone from travelling, you know, booking an EasyJet flight and going to Zagreb or going to Seville or wherever.
I mean, my only experience of covering England abroad has been with the under-21s and the women's team. And it, you know, it's fair to point out that, you know, there were obviously nothing like the same numbers, but there was none of that kind of stuff surrounded those two teams. So it's not a prerequisite for following England abroad to be.
And in Russia, there weren't that many England fans there. But certainly there was nothing, we didn't see what happened there that we saw in Seville or we saw in Amsterdam before the tournament as well. Ireland lost to Wales, Barry. And Wales looked quite good and young and energetic and exciting. And Ireland, it looked to me like a sort of under-18s team versus a strollers 11. They just gave you the runaround.
Yeah, well, Ireland have just played two of the worst games of football I've ever seen. They were just dreadful as spectacles. And while Wales were no great shakes either, they at least have young players coming through. They're five or six good young players, you know, making their mark on the team. They have Gareth Bale and Aaron Ramsey. They weren't playing the other night, but, you know, they're very, very good players. Ireland have none of those things. They don't have any apparent plan. You know, Gareth Southgate has a plan A and a plan B. Probably has a plan C as well. Martin O'Neill has... I really am at a loss to know what he tells his players to go out and do. I think before the Wales game, the opinion was divided in Ireland between people who thought he was doing the best he could with the very limited resources available to him, and then there were others who thought, no, his time was up, he's had his turn, it's time for someone else to come in. And I think opinion is no longer divided. I think people think it's time to go. He comes out with very lame excuses. You know, the point was made that Wales wouldn't have Bale, and he said, oh, well, we don't have Seamus Coleman, you know. And I think that Wales wouldn't have been looking forward to facing Seamus Coleman. Seamus Coleman is a very good player, but he ain't no Gareth Bale, is he? So there's not really any analysis you can do with Ireland. They've had three shots on target in two games. Shane Long is still playing up front. You know, Martin O'Neill, another drummy bangs, is that we don't have a natural goal scorer. You know, it's Shane Long up front, you can't fault him for effort, and there's not a great deal he can do when just the ball's been hoofed in his general direction five or six times a game. There's only so much you can do with that. But Shane Long has scored, I think, two goals in his last 65-odd appearances for club and country. So even if there is no natural goal scorer in the Irish squad or no Robbie Keane, someone must be better than that, you know. And Shane Long's 31 or 32 now. Give some young lad a chance. But he's also placed players out of position. Cyrus Christie has been in midfield for the last, centre midfield for the last two games, just looked lost.
I heard somewhere, and I don't know if it's a possible...
I'm just ranting.
No, it's good, but I heard somewhere, and it might not be true, so, you know, I'll caveat it with that Cyrus Christie didn't know he was playing centre-mid until an hour before kickoff, and hasn't played centre-mid since he was 14. And you sort of think that, if that is the case, that's ridiculous.
What are they doing in training? Like, what are they doing?
It's like a secret. Don't tell Cyrus. Everybody knows. Don't tell him. And then, oh yeah, you're just playing in front of the back four. Because football's a totally different... If you change position, everything you have to do is... I mean, short of controlling it and passing, it's completely different disciplines for different positions on the pitch. you're facing the, you know.
Yeah, well, watching him take the ball and try to turn was, it was just comical. And, you know, he was doing his best, but if you feel you need to play a fullback in the centre of midfield, you got to tell him and warn and help him on the training pitch. But they clearly didn't do so, which begs the question, what are they doing on the training pitch?
Harry Wilson's got a lovely free kick, Hayley. When Gareth Bale returns, do you think Harry Wilson will say, sorry, Gareth, these are mine, anything from 25 yards out?
Absolutely. He'll grab those white boots and put them on. They're mine.
He's
bye-bye, Bale.
Yeah, he's promising, though, Wilson, isn't he? I mean, he did exactly the same thing for Derby against Manchester United, a couple of weeks ago, which makes you think Darren Randolph should have stayed where he was, I guess.
Perhaps. And I like his name. He's got a good English name.
It's a sort of proper footballer's name.
Yes, Harry Wilson.
Yeah, could have been playing in the 20s or something.
Yes.
Or a good Welsh name. It is more Harold Wilson. I mean, it's quite, yeah. It's got a good old school Prime Minister
name. An old school
name.
Well,
yeah.
That's what I meant.
Will O'Neill go, John?
It sounds like the public opinion is against him.
Well, a respected
so much.
Journalist has spoken.
I think once the respected journalists start turning on you, then you got you're in trouble.
The problem is, though, I don't think the FAI can afford to fire him. Like he signed a new contract last year, I think a 4-year deal, and the FAI are in such a financially perilous position that they can't afford to sack him. So that's a tricky one. And then who would you get? Mick McCarthy is. Made it fairly clear he would be open to an approach to take over again. I'd be happy if he took the job, but
would Roy Keane stay as assistant?
I very much doubt it.
On the flip side, John, Ryan Giggs seems to be doing good
things.
Yeah,
I thought Wales were terrific, and in sort of a similar way to England, it's a very young team. I think the average age of the front six was under 22 on average. Eight players, I think, from the under-21s qualifying cycle have been called up to the squad. So he's putting plenty of faith in the youth team. I wonder as well if, when you look at, say, David Brooks, who was brilliant for them, I thought, on, when was it, Saturday night? Was it Saturday night? Monday night? Tuesday night?
Tuesday night.
You look at somebody like David Brooks, who was brilliant for them on Tuesday night, and he was playing for the England under-20s in Toulon not much more than a year ago. But the Wales have managed to persuade him to turn out for them. And you look at, I think Tyler Roberts, who played up front, had the option of playing for England rather than Wales. And Ben Woodburn, the Liverpool forward, also has that choice but has opted for Wales. Whereas with Ireland, you've got Martin O'Neill, who in Ireland have already lost, but Grealish has already decided that he's going to attempt to play for England. We've got this current issue with Declan Rice, who's trying to make his mind up, apparently. So you do wonder with those, you know, I'm sure most of it is how the players sort of self-identify. But I think it'd be naive to think that they weren't looking at the people in charge and the sort of trajectories of the teams. And at the moment, you'd be quite happy to go and play for Ryan Giggs. And I think with Ireland, you're sort of thinking, well, yeah, I'm not sure if I want to go and play for Roy Keane and Martin O'Neill.
In Group B3, Bosnia 2, Northern Ireland 0. Third defeat in 3 for Northern Ireland in the Nations League. Edin Dzeko got both. They failed to score in their last 6 away games. They haven't played terribly. You do wonder, Hayley, if Michael O'Neill should have gone on to either to Scotland or to another job when his stock was so high, because what he got out of a sort of a decent but not spectacular set of players in the Euros was unbelievable. And was he ever going to achieve those heights? And it's a difficult choice for a manager to know whether to stick or twist, I guess.
He could have gone to Scotland, being paid a lot less money, I think, and had less quality players and just thought, why the heck would I even consider doing this? He's obviously still very passionate about things. You look at the situation with... I've been researching Hamilton Rangers, which is our live game at the weekend. Kyle Lafferty pulled out of the squad. It was midnight on Sunday, apparently, he received a call after he played for Rangers saying, I'm not feeling great. I've got an injury. I've got an Achilles issue. And probably because he couldn't be bothered to go and play. I don't know. He didn't want to play.
Yeah.
He might be injured. But if he wanted to play for Rangers at the weekend... Well, he's not going to be able to, because the Irish FA have actually, they've applied to FIFA and they've enacted that ruling where if a player pulls out of a national team, they can't play for their club within 5 days of pulling out of the national team. So he could, in fact, miss Rangers game on Sunday. So that obviously
he will miss it, yeah.
He will. Yeah. So he will be, he's obviously that incensed about him not, and maybe he thinks he didn't want to play for the club, because why would you do that? You just trust that the player was actually injured and that he wouldn't be playing if it's an Achilles problem.
It just doesn't bode well, does it, for future relations?
No.
You know, once a...
Lafferty and O'Neill have had a fairly fractious relationship. You know, Lafferty's a... He's a bit of a flute, isn't he? Well, probably not a right choice of words, actually. But we're talking about a Rangers player from Northern Ireland. But he's a bit flaky, isn't he? And I think he had the hump because he wasn't first choice selection for Northern Ireland.
Do you want to choose a different woodwind instrument? A bassoon? Yeah, clarinet?
A bassoon.
He's a bit of a corps anglais. That's what he is. Well, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll look at the other Nations League games. Welcome back to the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Excellent biscuits, by the way, Hayley.
Thank you very much.
I really enjoyed them. I'll go and see that lady for all my biscuit needs.
And only your biscuit needs. You're a married man now.
Yes. Oh, I would have said even before, I still would have only gone to her for biscuits. Before we get started with part two, I wanted to tell you about The Guardian's new daily podcast that launches on the 1st of November. Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian, taking you behind the headlines for a deeper understanding of the news. Every weekday you'll hear from the personal perspectives and expert analysis from the respected Guardian journalists at the centre of our biggest stories. Subscribe to Today in Focus on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. All right, back to the Nations League. Group A won, France 2. Germany won. The first time Germany have lost two competitive games in a row since Euro 2000. Didn't tell the whole story. They conceded a late penalty, which was pretty unlucky, and played quite well in the first half. Argentina 0, Brazil 1. Miranda's last-minute header, the difference in the Super Classico, as they played as part of a four-team tournament in Saudi Arabia. And Gibraltar 2, Liechtenstein 1. As I said in the intro, I copied it from Phil I Am. Can it be argued, Barry, that Gibraltar are the most successful team on the Iberian Peninsula on current form?
I suppose it could, yeah. I don't know how Portugal have been doing. I do know they won at least one game, but...
Don't spoil the narrative. Yes.
Is Gibraltar actually on the Iberian Peninsula? I don't know.
Don't spoil the geography.
Isn't it an island?
No.
No.
Gibraltar's not an island.
My geography is terrible. Yeah.
It's joined on.
It's definitely joined on.
With what?
Land. Joined on with land. I mean,
I think that is what you call an isthmus.
Hopefully.
A little narrow sliver of land.
There's a little bridge.
Hopefully Today in Focus, the new podcast from The Guardian, will be slightly geographically more astute than we are. Anyway, well done to Gibraltar. They came back from 1-0 down to beat Liechtenstein. Okay, then Wembley. Shahid Khan's withdrawn his offer to buy the National Stadium. He was going to offer £600 million. He's decided that he was likely to lose this vote, or it was dividing opinion, so he's pulled out. He says, I cannot rule out revisiting the opportunity at another time. Football Association family is unified in its views. Your thoughts, please, John Ashdown.
Yeah, I'm kind of torn on it a little bit, really, because it does feel like a bit of a victory for the greybeards in the suits, doesn't it? And the sort of traditionalists and that type of thing. But at the same time, there is so much money flowing into the game in the Premier League that you sort of wonder whether this one-off lump sum payment would really be the magic bullet that it's been sort of sold as, when perhaps better in a longer term, increasing the percentage of Premier League money that goes to grassroots might be a better solution. So yeah, I'm slightly split on it, really.
Could we? I mean, there's nothing to enforce the Premier League to do that.
No,
they
have an agreement.
They've got a 5% agreement.
5% that they haven't actually paid. They're at 3.6 or something at the moment.
And 1.4% of a lot is quite a lot of money, isn't it?
Yeah.
Would that rectify things? I don't know.
Well, this is one of the things that I don't quite understand. I mean, going off the is it the Football Foundation who sort of administer grassroots? They've said they've had in their statement, in which they said that the grassroots they said it was a real shame and it was a once in a lifetime opportunity missed, and described a lot of grassroots facilities in this country as shameful. They explained they'd had something like 600 million from various authorities since 2000, which they've turned into 1.5 billion using sort of agreements with local authorities and such like. And so in the last 18 years, they've had this 1.5 billion and we've still ended up with grassroots facilities that are apparently shameful, which is something I don't quite understand. So if they're saying we're going to get another 1.2 billion from this deal, who's to say that you know that would fix anything?
There are other questions as well, aren't there? If the FA at some point did sell Wembley and they got the money, do we trust the FA to spend it in the right way?
I think you'd have to. Wouldn't there be some kind of agreement where you get together with the Football Foundation, the Premier League, and you would have to decide exactly where the money was going and not just put it on a bus and drive it around Wembley and promise us that the money is going back into grassroots football?
Barry?
I'm guessing...
You're respected.
I really am not, particularly in here. Wasn't there a suggestion that Daniel Levy used some clout because the new Spurs stadium will be hosting American football games, and he was concerned that Wembley would take NFL games away from them. So, there's also the question, I don't think there's any need for the FA to own Wembley, and I would prefer an England team that travels around playing in different parts of the country, because Wembley can be quite accessible, or is very inaccessible for an awful lot of England fans. So I don't really care whether they sell it or not, but I know Michael...
And they didn't own it until 1999, which is an important point. So the sort of argument that this has been, the FA has been, you know, we've owned our stadium forever and it's a vital historical thing is bogus.
Yeah, I know Michael Calvin, who's been on Football Weekly and is also officially respected as a journalist.
He's
very exercised about this and was giving out and being cross
on what way?
Twitter.
On what side?
He thinks the FA should have sold it, and you know he was complaining that now grassroots pitches will be waterlogged for the next 5 months, and you know this is going to continue to happen.
Something like 147,000 amateur games were called off last year.
Wow.
You know, I mean, I very rarely, I get so many games cancelled in December and January and February. And then you start playing, you know, double headers on Wednesday nights and it's harder to get enough players there. And actually, it's harder to recruit young players now because there's so many other things to do or so few people are playing. So the question is how... if that has any impact on the game at the highest level, right? Why should the Premier League care about that? They should probably maybe care that under 10s can't play. But they certainly don't need to care that I'm unlikely to affect it. Do you know what I mean? I wonder why we have this feeling that there's so much money in football and it doesn't sit right that park pitches are useless. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the people with all the money should just give it to the parks, right?
I suppose, although, you know, we're the football family, aren't we? You know, everything's, in theory, everything's kind of connected in that way. I mean, the thing is, I don't see... Having said, you know, would this be a magic bullet that it's been sort of offered as, I still don't see... I'm with Baz, there's no need to hold for the FA to hold on to Wembley. It's not a very good stadium, quite frankly. It's certainly not a very good... place to watch your team play, particularly if your team is Sheffield United, because they lose there every time they go there. I don't see the point of them. I don't see the downside of selling it necessarily if it does generate this huge wadge of cash. But it does need to be used correctly, and you'd like to see the Premier League give a bit more.
And there was an argument that this move all came about quite quickly, and it wasn't really put out to tender in an official way. And £600 million is probably not enough money. I mean, Wembley should be bought for more money than this.
Well, didn't it cost nearly over 800 million? And, you know, out of this deal, the FA were still going to be doing quite well out of it. They still have the hospitality and all that. So, look, I'm not business-minded or financially astute enough to be able to comment on this with any huge amount of knowledge, whether it was a good deal or whether it was done the right way, or whether it would have been a good deal or whether it would have been done in the right way. It was done in the right way, but so, yeah. stop asking me hard questions. I don't know the answers to.
You want me to go back to the yogurt pot questions, Barry? That's how you got respected, didn't you? I loved how that stream of consciousness saying, I'm not really that knowledgeable about this. I can barely string a sentence together now, so I don't know. I'm just going to shut down. Boom! Like an old telly. It just went back to just a dot in the middle of your nose, didn't it? Hey, the Premier League's back, the best league in the world, with all its money that it doesn't give to me, so I can play on a carpet. Game of the weekend, Hayley, is Chelsea versus Manchester United. And if Chelsea win, they are 10 points ahead of Manchester United after just 9 games.
I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? But awful when you put it like that. Mm. And I can't see Man United getting anything from this. I just can't. I know Mourinho would love nothing more than to head back to his old club and come away with something. But I just think the way that things are with the club behind the scenes and the way that Mourinho is so miserable and just unhappy, and the news as well this week that the players have come out to say that they're really unhappy that these pundits and experts are just constantly being negative about them and Manchester United. It's like, just get on with it. Just play the football that we'd all love to see and forget about what anybody else has to say.
What does your old man have to say? And for the benefit of any listeners who may not know, Hayley's dad is Gordon McQueen, who's a Man U legend.
That is him.
What's his opinion on?
Well, I know my dad's opinion, a bit like mine. When United were looking for a new manager, not straight after Sir Alex Ferguson, but when Pep Guardiola became available, that was the man. I was like, please, 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 please. I'd always thought, actually, when Sir Alex goes, Mourinho, we missed out on him. Of course, we had Moyes and then Van Gaal. And then suddenly it was like, finally, Mourinho's going to be the saviour. But we got the Mourinho, which is a very different Mourinho to the man that I thought was coming in. I wanted the Mourinho from 10 years ago, not the Mourinho that we've got now. I don't enjoy him. He doesn't give me enthusiasm. He doesn't make me feel happy about anything. And if he's making me feel like that, what's he making his players feel like? My dad basically said, we should have got Pep Guardiola.
There was a brilliant story in the Daily Mirror today that, you know, the current players are very angry with all the ex-pros, you know, Scholes, especially Rio and Gary Neville, criticising them, which is, you know, they're paid to be pundits. If your team is playing badly, you're going to be criticised. And a story that they're showing each other videos of, you know, Gary Neville making defensive blunders and, you know, Paul Scholes miscontrolling it a bit and then flying into a two-footed challenge. I mean, look, it could be total bollocks, right? There's a high chance that is utter nonsense. Well,
go out and show them that, oh, I don't know.
Well, there is an easy way to stop the criticism, and that is to play better football. It's just easy.
Yeah.
But Chelsea are flying, aren't they? Chelsea are, you know, top of the league, aren't they?
United's record at Stamford Bridge is horrible as well. I think they've lost 8 of the last 9 trips. And yeah, you can just see Hazard making a lot of hay between those dodgy defensive lines that United have.
Hazard's a very good record against United. I think he scored 5 goals against them and also got 2 different United players sent off. And I think it'll be interesting to see if they try and do a man-marking job on him. Probably that would fall to Ander Herrera if he's fit, and I think it worked out so well for Ander the last time he did it. I think he got sent off but
they just don't play well at Chelsea either. I've been there 4-5 times to Stamford Bridge and never seen United win, never, and never actually play particularly good.
Man City, so much optimism for, you know, they did beat, you know, there might be a bit of feel good from that Newcastle game. Just for a bit of balance.
Yeah, it came at a good time because it does at least mean that over the international break, they had that sort of 3-2 win in the last sort of half of football they played before the international break was a good one. Although it did feel like a little bit like the FA was trolling earlier in the week when they announced their FA charge for Mourinho for his comments on camera.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely right, isn't it? You can't just swear down a camera lens, can you?
No, it was just the timing of it. Felt like, you know, it was just a quiet afternoon at St George's Park and like some FA suits like, what should we do? Let's go and watch that Mourinho video, shall we? Put out a statement.
They get lip readers. They paid to get lip readers
in. That's
right,
yeah. Because he said, didn't he say it in Portuguese?
Yes. Portuguese lip readers, I hope they got it. Or lip readers who can understand Portuguese. It's a niche job. I bet you never thought when you became a Portuguese lip reader that you'd be called into St. George's Park to see Jose swearing at you after a victory. Man City are home to Burnley. Barry, what will you give me if Burnley win this game?
Good seeing too.
I don't know how to take that.
I mean, wasn't expecting the question. The first thing that came to mind.
Okay, well,
I'm not sure why, and I'm slightly alarmed that it is.
I really hope Man City tonk them, if I'm really honest. It's 0-0 with 10 minutes left. I might not come into work on Sunday. Anyway, so look, Man City at home to Burnley, so that sort of looks relatively straightforward to them.
Kevin De Bruyne is agitating for a starting spot, apparently after returning from injury, and he's back at just the right time. We all know how good he is, but they've 7 games coming up in the next 21 days, so it will be, to use an old cliche, like a new signing for them.
John, Liverpool go to Huddersfield. They've got quite a few injury problems. Van Dijk's been playing with broken ribs, which is, if you've never had them, just one of the most painful things in the history of time. You breathe.
I had a bruised rib not that long ago, and it was horrible.
Every time you breathe, you can feel it. And when a sneeze is coming, it's like hell on earth. You're like, how can I stop this? It's coming and there's nothing I can do. Naby Keita was... There were no stretchers at the game that he was injured at, and one of his teammates gave him a piggyback off the pitch.
Which
is brilliantly Sunday League, isn't it? Even still... Salah was injured, Mane as well, maybe. I'm not sure how many of those are definitely going to miss the game or are definitely going to play, but you'd imagine they have the strength and depth.
Yeah, you'd think they'd still have enough. The 2 games last season between the sides were pretty one-sided, and yeah, even with the injuries, you'd still expect Liverpool to do enough there, I think.
West Ham play Spurs, Newcastle versus Brighton. Lots of rumours about Rafa Benitez. Did we say this on Monday that Mike Ashley was planning to sack Rafa Benitez to avoid a backlash from the Newcastle fan? I mean, I'm not sure how that works at all, because I think that ship has sailed anyway, and I'm not sure sacking Rafa would be a particularly good idea.
The only thing about that is Mike Ashley can't really make Newcastle fans hate him any more than they already do, but it, in terms of self-PR, it would be a baffling move.
Chris Hughton would love nothing more, though, wouldn't he, than to get a win over Newcastle the way that he went out, and then make sure that they're in a whole load of mess yet again.
Yeah, absolutely. Wolves-Watford, Everton Palace is Sunday at 4, and Arsenal-Leicester on Monday. This Aaron Ramsey story is interesting. Is it interesting, John? Aaron Ramsey running his contract down, or Arsenal withdrawing the contract?
Yeah, well, he said that they'd, over the international break, he said that a deal had been agreed and that Arsenal essentially pulled the plug on it, which does seem bizarre, and it seems, very strange that they're going to let him go at the end of the season.
All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll look ahead to the Championship and Hayley McQueen's Fit Bar Corner. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Here's a question from Peter. Why are the EFL bleating about 11 sports broadcasting European matches on Saturday at 3 p.m. when they seem happy to ignore Article 48? Sounds like one of those complicated questions, Barry. During international breaks, in order to stream live UK games, this must have a bigger impact on attendances at lower league grounds. So this is 11 sports were going to break that rule that only England, Scotland and Montenegro for some reason, follow, which is a complete blackout of football at 3 p.m. on a Saturday afternoon.
Haven't they been doing it with La Liga, though, already? They have been playing games that they shouldn't have.
They had been doing it, and now they've stopped doing it.
Okay.
But they say, we think we should be able to do it, but we're not going to do it. So do we think this is sacrosanct and should stay forever? Because the idea being that's the thin end of the wedge, right? If La Liga starts showing it, eventually it'll get to a stage where Soccer Saturday could have all the goals in it, a bit like the European Goals Show, and that would make that a more, interesting watch. Certainly you can watch EFL games on the red button, and I think a lot of away fans go, I'm not going to travel all the way there if I can just watch this game.
Yeah, it would have an impact as well, because you've seen in some of the midweek games in the Football League, attendances are down because you can do the iPlayer. Not iPlayer, is it? But the streaming service that the clubs are offering now, and it has affected attendances. But it is slightly peculiar. I was in the States last Christmas, and it was brilliant because you could just watch football constantly while you were there. I mean, obviously the fixtures are spread out, but including that 3 o'clock kickoff spot on the Saturday. And it does seem slightly odd that, you know, fans elsewhere in the world can see 3 o'clock football in English fans can't.
Which, it does.
British fans can't.
But you think League One and League Two sides. If there was a big game on a Saturday at 3 o'clock,
yeah, I think it's
involving
the top
four sides, yeah. Like you would just, I think you would see those lower league attendances plummet.
Ireland, you'll know they have the 3 o'clock Premier League kickoff, get to show live games. I did it for Sky for a couple of years. It was quite good fun being involved in a 3 o'clock kickoff in the afternoon as well. Whilst all the other scores, I was like a mini Jeff Stelling in another studio, locked away where only Ireland could watch. Yeah, but it was good fun and a little bit different.
Barry,
yeah, it's a thing I don't have a strong opinion on, but I don't think there's any harm with how things are at the moment, and I do concur that it would affect attendances and affect the attendances of clubs who can't afford to have lower attendances and need every penny. So
it's the one tradition in football that we've still got when there are not many traditions left. And how much more football do we need? Friday night, Saturday morning, Saturday night, back-to-back games on a Sunday, Monday night football. Just let Saturday afternoon be for the fans who want to go to the grounds. That's where I stand on that. Okay. My rant.
The first round of applause since I've been here anyway.
Well, I've been useless up until now, frankly.
I totally agree. The first thing I would do when I take over football is strip Thursday nights. You know, Europa League can go on a Tuesday.
I just can't be bothered with the Europa League anymore because, yeah, there was one week not too long ago I'd watched a game Friday, Saturday, a couple on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then you just can't be dealing with Arsenal against whoever on the Thursday night.
Didn't Sky, and obviously I spent a long time never criticising Sky because they were paying me and now they're not. they put Ian Holloway in a bus, right, and made him drive around the country and do a championship game every day for 10 days. And I think Ian Holloway took his wife in a coach, and they had a bed in the coach. And like they had an assistant producer like in a bed underneath their bed.
I wonder how he sold that to her. We're going on a trip around the country. Very picturesque.
Well, there was a documentary once where Ian Holloway was one of several celebrities who did art therapy in a bid to calm him down after matches, and we got to see life in the Holloway household. And his wife is a very, very nice woman with the patience of a saint.
He's a nice man. Yeah. He built a chicken coop for us on Soccer AM once.
Yeah,
that was lovely. I think when they got promoted to the Premier League, I forget who he was with. It was Blackpool?
Blackpool, it would have been, yeah.
Then he didn't want to build chicken coops for us anymore. He thought he should probably take being a manager more seriously, which is probably fair enough. Championship Minute with John Ashdown.
Yeah.
Villa Swansea, a lot of eyes on this for a number of reasons. It's Dean Smith's first game in charge. John Terry, obviously, there as assistant manager. And the first game at Villa Park since Doug Ellis passed away as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's quite an annoying appointment, actually, for fans of other championship teams, because I think it's a pretty good one. Whereas if, you know, the potential for things going horribly wrong if Villa had brought Thierry Henry in was much higher. And Dean Smith is a very, very safe pair of hands, done a fantastic job at Brentford. And there is tons of talent there at Villa. And they're only sort of, you know, they are 15th, I think it is, but the division is so compressed, you know, they could still win the title. You know, it's that close still.
And will Dean Smith play free-flowing, beautiful football? What's his style?
Well, it'd be interesting to see, actually, given you know, Brentford very much a passing team and had a recruitment strategy that worked for them. But obviously, that's a place where expectations are a lot lower. And Villa Park, you know, given the time that fans have had of it over the last sort of, you know, 5-6 years, I guess. Isn't a particularly patient place, I don't think, at the moment. So he will be under pressure to get results, and it'll be interesting to see how he copes with that.
Sheffield United, top of the league, top of the championship at the moment. West Brom and their boiler man are second. Bielsa's Leeds in third as well. It's astonishingly tight at the top of that league, isn't it?
It is, and all the way down. United are top on the sort of basis of having been brilliant since the losing the first couple of games of the season, but also because Borough and Leeds have gone off the boil ever so slightly. It's really unexpected, to be honest, that the success that there's been at Bramall Lane so far this season, because they did end last season in a bit of a mess. Well, mess might be a bit strong, but they certainly tailed off quite strongly and ended the season with Chris Wilder threatening to walk away because the owners had fallen out, essentially. And it didn't look like there'd be a great deal of progress over the summer. In fact, there wasn't a huge amount, although the owners did sort themselves out over the summer period. And United did quietly break their transfer record for John Egan from Brentford. But then they still went on and lost the first two games. So the expectation was that it was going to be a real struggle to move on from the ninth place finish last year. But it's all clicked. I mean, Chris Wilder, the job that he's done there is absolutely extraordinary, really. You know, they have, as I say, they did break the transfer record, but he's improved so many players that you think of as sort of lower league journeymen. You think of, you know, Leon Clark is the biggest example, because over the last, you know, 2.5 seasons, he's basically been prolific in a way that he hasn't for the entirety of the rest of his career. And he's sort of been doing the same this season with David McGoldrick. So, he's doing a fantastic job. And we just sort of, as United fans, hope we can hold on to him, really.
Sheffield Wednesday actually could do you guys a bit of a favour by beating Middlesbrough as well.
On Friday night, yeah.
Yeah, and you only had two players involved in Nations League. I think Borough had about seven. The last time they had an international break, Middlesbrough lost to Norwich. And we know how Tony Pulis works. He's very meticulous about his preparation and having time as well with his players, and maybe doesn't cope as well when he hasn't had just a week where he has his specific routines. I know when he came into Middlesbrough, 6 o'clock in the morning, he wanted everybody staff to be in so that he could make sure he could use the gym, he could do specific things and have a very set way of doing things.
How many people have to get in at six?
I think there's only a couple now. Okay. Yeah, I think they gave him the keys to make sure he could get into the gym before everybody else came into work.
Oh, wow. That is, because getting in for six, that means you have to get up before six.
Yeah.
And really getting up at six is the earliest you should really ever have to get up.
And I imagine he's the type that would be walking his dog at five. He's that type, isn't he?
Yeah.
Well, I have a dog.
He keeps himself very fit, doesn't he? He does sponsored cycles and rolls from London to, I don't know, Mexico or whatever.
Which would you rather do, cycle or row to Mexico? It's quite hard to cycle.
I would rather do neither.
John, you're a Football League expert. Cambridge United are currently second bottom in League Two, and I sort of was joking about this quite a lot at the start of the season, being unlucky that we kept losing. But now we keep losing, and I'm terrified.
Don't be afraid, Max. That's all I could say there. Okay. You'll be fine. You'll be fine. Also, you've been in non-league before, and it wasn't that bad, was it?
I mean, it's so bad. Hayley, we have a Fitbar Corner every week, and every week lots of Scottish people message us to say we don't really take Scottish football seriously. I blame Barry. Barry blames me.
There is a lot of finger pointing.
There is.
And a lot of blame to go around.
So for once, we can have an absolutely perfect Fitbar Corner and we'll get praised. And any praise you get, we will take the credit for. Hearts are still top of the Scottish Premiership, mm-hmm. and deservedly so. How are they playing?
Yeah, very, very well indeed. I think it was slightly unexpected as well that they would do so well. I think it's just very refreshing to have these two Edinburgh teams who are currently battling out at the top of the table. People say order will be resumed as soon as Celtic start to pick up a bit of momentum, which they've done, of course. Good win over Aberdeen and a thumping of St Johnstone as well. They started to score the goals. Things were looking a bit disjointed. They were kind of going through the motions at the start of the season. I think we all thought with Gerrard coming in, who grabbed a lot of the headlines, that it would be just Rangers and Celtic near the top. I know it's been Celtic and Aberdeen battling for the top two spots over the last few seasons, but people were thinking that, oh, Rangers are just going to gradually sneak up and we'll have that battle of the Glasgow rivals back again. We'll have that famous Old Firm and it will mean something. I think when you a couple of games that I've covered so far with Celtic and Rangers, particularly the last derby that we had, Rangers are still very, very far behind. I think it'd be disrespectful to say that there's the title race up there will be between Rangers and Celtic and then Aberdeen. I think it's great that we have these Edinburgh clubs. And I think the fact that Hearts didn't actually have that pressure on them coming into the season has made sure that they're up there.
You bought Uche Ikpeazu from Cambridge.
What a name.
Ah, Uche is like it was a cult hero for us. I mean, it does make you question how good the Scottish Premiership is if someone who is doing reasonably well in League Two can make an impact.
It is a bit of a shame, and especially when Scottish teams are losing good players as well, the likes of Salford losing players to Salford. Yeah. You think, what is going wrong here? And that impacts as well on the Scottish national team. When you just look at the squad list, yes, they're a team. When Gordon Strachan had the Scotland team, he was building them around the Celtic players, but they've got players who were starting for Sunderland, you know, League One players. But there's a lot of interesting names as well in the Scottish Premiership. Ziggy Gordon for Hamilton, my favourite name. Absolutely. He was playing out in Poland somewhere and they brought him back.
I like Ziggy Gordon. Yeah. That's excellent. So Hibs go to Celtic, which is a huge game, isn't it? Because were Hibs expected to be challenging?
I think they were. I think Hibs' home form has been excellent. They're quite an exciting team to watch, if you can call them exciting.
Can call them exciting.
Okay, that's fine. I think what Hibs have got that other teams don't have, again, is the fact that people aren't expecting too much of them at the moment.
And do you think either Hearts or Hibs could maintain a run?
I still think Aberdeen are going to sneak up there. Do you? I really do, yeah. And the Rangers fans will hate me for saying this. I think.
Do you want to say it then?
what happened at the start of the season with Celtic, with a few of the problems about talk of Brendan Rodgers potentially wanting to leave in the summer. Was he going to go to China? As soon as a big job comes up in the Premier League, is he going to go there? Is he going to go to Aston Villa? He's always one of those names linked. And I think a lot of his players were thinking, well, maybe that's it. He's won the double treble. How much more can he actually do? If he wants to leave, respect. He's brought us all these trophies and he can just go. And you get the feeling that maybe some of the players are thinking, well, if he's off, am I really with him? Are we still buying into this? What is the future for Scottish football? He wasn't given the money in the summer, which he'd hoped he would be given to keep building his team. Some say, oh, they've got such a massive squad. Why would they still need these players? Well, you look at how dreadful Celtic and Rangers have. Well, maybe not Rangers so much at the moment in the Europa League, but certainly with Champions League football and needing that and the money that comes with that as well. You just have to think, well, he does want to have a squad that is challenging in Europe. And so what if he's got a lot more money than your likes of St Johnson and your Hamiltons and your Motherwells out there? He deserves it and they deserve it. But it does put them a lot further ahead than the other teams in terms of money, quality. And it makes it less interesting for those fans who want to see a bit of a challenge in the Premiership.
Presumably, Rodgers' choice is either go to the next big club or stay and try and get 10 in a row, right? Because that puts you down in the annals of history of Scottish football.
Of course, which I think a lot of Celtic fans would be loving, and of course, Rangers fans hating. There's still that, despite the fact that there is a gap between these two clubs, and there's the argument that you could call Rangers, they're not an old firm side anymore, and it's not the old firm. There is still, that is the rivalry.
Yeah, sure.
It's one of the biggest rivalries in the world. I was really shocked. Obviously, I'm quite new to presenting Scottish football, but I grew up in Scotland and had a real understanding of this hatred between, and it is pure hatred between this set of fans. And until you go to your first game and actually watch it, the first we did was at Celtic Park, I was blown away just by how bitter it still was between the fans.
How is Stephen Gerrard doing?
Rangers have had the worst start to a top flight campaign in over 20 years when you look at the records of Pedro Caixinha and Mark Warburton. He actually statistically hasn't done any better, but what he has brought is a spotlight to Scottish football, which it definitely needs. And he's definitely brought an enthusiasm. He's brought in other players. He's building his own side, and he's trying to work a few things out. Maybe hasn't worked to... hasn't quite gone to plan for him yet. I think things will come together, but that has to be a real long term thing. You're not just going to bring in a big name like Steven Gerrard in his first managerial job, looking after this huge club. He's going to click his fingers, wave a magic wand, and everything's just going to be great.
Were you surprised he took it? I mean, I thought it was a fascinating choice.
I'm not surprised he took it. I'm surprised they gave it to him, because I just presumed with what had happened with Caixinha that they would be looking for somebody who was experienced, who was already a big name manager, not just a big name in the game, but somebody that could come in and help put together a bit of a disjointed team. He's very, very good at making sure he's playing a lot of young players, which I think is really exciting to see. So you are looking to the future, but fans want to see instant results. Maybe not going to happen with Rangers just yet. But I was surprised when they gave him the job. I'm glad they did, because, as I've mentioned, it does put a spotlight on Scottish football and makes his media conferences more exciting. There are a lot more fans and press. And you look at the viewing figures of Scottish football. His first game, which was against Aberdeen up at Pittodrie, it had over 700,000 viewers at peak, which is massive for Scottish football.
And that, Barry, is how you do a football corner.
I agree, but I would venture to say there will still be complaints.
Hey, a petition calling for a picture of Harry Maguire riding an inflatable unicorn has garnered over 25,000 signatures to be the new face of the £50 note. Are you behind it? The petition was started by Johnny Sharples, who hopes Maguire's representation of core British values, bravery, strength and a big head will persuade the Bank of England to seriously consider his suggestion. Unfortunately, it looks unlikely that they will consider the request, as they avoid fictional characters and people that are living. And the unicorn is the national animal of Scotland, apparently. So I didn't know that until this morning. And I said it to Dean Saunders, and he was like, "What? A mythical animal? The national animal of Scotland? That's ridiculous." To which many people texted in to remind him that a dragon... Anyway, somebody...
I would be behind that. I mean, you don't see many 50s, though, do you? I can't remember the last time I had a £50 note.
I don't think I've ever had one. I don't know. I've seen one.
It could be something even more ridiculous on it at the moment.
Producer Sammy got someone to do this. Who did this, Sammy? This is someone called Adam Farquharson, who is, I presume, an aristocratic gent with a lot of time on his hand. But he's put Barry, that's sort of your mugshot from the last time you were arrested, I imagine, Barry, on a £50 note. I would love your face to be on that.
So would I.
Would the Glenn Dennings be proud?
I would imagine so.
This is a question from Gavin. What's the least deserving item Hayley has had to announce from the breaking ticker on Sky Sports News? I nominate volcanic ash cloud, tonight Speedway under threat.
Oh my gosh.
When you have to take the breaking news, when the yellow ticker comes in and it's really not that exciting. Or...
There's one that sticks in my mind that I can't... I'm not sure why it sticks in my mind, but the yellow breaking news ticker, it was Zat Knight had signed a new 1-year deal with Bolton.
I think on deadline day, when there's absolutely nothing happening and you've got a League One player who's signed a contract extension, you're like, well, there's nothing in this 15 minutes to go with, so we'll just put the spotlight on League One for a moment.
There was one deadline day where nothing happened, and then on Soccer AM we did a DVD of, you know, you could buy the DVD, and we just cut to lots of reporters going, "There's nothing happening here," and we had our knuckles wrapped for.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This is from Bavarian Hammer on the subject of Podders sleeping in the spare room. I don't know if any of you do this. Both Lars Sivertsen and Andy Brassel, if they're covering a game late, will go into the spare room when they get home as to not to wake up their better halves. The Podders sleeping in the spare room may avoid waking the husband-wife, but also means they're not disturbed in the early morning, so not as selfless as first claimed.
I mean, I'm still sleeping in, or we're still sleeping in the spare room after the ceiling
collapsed. Oh, yes, I forgot. Yeah, so. How is it? The ceiling collapsed in on Mrs. Ashdown.
Yeah, so she was in bed and I was working late. And yeah, the ceiling just fell in on her. She was fine.
Have you taken the rubble off her yet? Or has it
been gone? The rubble's all gone, thankfully. And it's been plastered, so we're getting there.
Good. I mean, people have been... I mean, the amount of questions we got about that, I can't believe I didn't ask it earlier. Sean says, "Hi, Max. I just listened to your Football Weekly podcast mentioning Eswatini. It's pronounced Eswatini, as in E-H, rather than Eswatini. Thank you. I've really enjoyed that, so I've been living here for 9 years and listen to the pod every week. I'm originally from Ireland, and listening to Barry's soothing curmudgeon brogue always makes me homesick. Why does Lars have an Irish accent? I missed the explanation. It was awkward to ask now. We believe..."
His significant other is from Cork, and he's obviously picked it up from her.
And he thought that would be the quickest way to become a respected journalist, would be to just develop an Irish accent.
Speak like somebody off Derby O'Gill and the Little People.
I will finish this with from Samir saying, "Hi, greetings from Vancouver. I'm an avid listener to the pod, along with my wife Nadia, both football lovers. I love the pod, especially more lately as my wife and I are apart for work. But we listen to the pod together and then we chat about it as if we were on the couch while we're hundreds of miles apart. I would love it if you would shout out a birthday wish for Nadia on the 18th of October pod. I would really appreciate it. Barry, if you could do the honours... to wish Nadia a happy birthday."
Happy birthday, Nadia, and I hope I speak for all of us when I say I hope you have many, many more of them.
This one from the Harlequin. "Why is this only available as a podcast? I'm quite interested in reading an article or transcript of the subjects discussed as described, but I'm not going to listen to a podcast. So, Sam, if you could just note down everything we've just said in the last hour and we'll put it out as an article. Thank you, Barry."
You're welcome.
"Thank you, Ashes."
Cheers.
"Thank you, Hayley."
"Thanks for having me."
I'm away for two pods. And so Mel Rudd, formerly producer Mel, is sitting in. She is a Norwich fan. And Barry, please make sure that she isn't too good, please.
I will endeavour to do so.
Thank you very much. I'll be back in a couple of weeks. Or a week. Or 10 days, whatever.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.